Out of the Silent Planet, continued. Ransom was just finishing his protracted meal when he saw Devine stiffen like a dog and lay his hand in silence on Weston's shoulder. Both nodded. They rose. Ransom, gulping down the last of his whiskey, rose too. He found himself between his two captors. Both revolvers were out. They were edging him to the shore of the narrow water, and they were looking and pointing across it. At first he could not see clearly what they were pointing at. There seemed to be some paler and slenderer plants than he had noticed amongst the purple ones. He hardly attended to them, for his eyes were busy searching the ground. So obsessed was he with the reptile fears and insect fears of modern imagining. It was the reflections of the new white objects in the water that sent his eyes back to them. Long, streaky white reflections, motionless in the running water, four or five, no, to be precise, six of them. He looked up. Six white things were standing there, spindly and flimsy things, twice or three times the height of a man. His first idea was that they were images of men, the work of savage artists. He had seen things like them in books of archaeology. But what could they be made of? And how could they stand? So crazily thin and elongated in the leg, so top-heavily pouted in the chest, such stocky, flexible-looking distortions of earthly bipeds, like something seen in one of those comic mirrors. They were certainly not made of stone or metal, for now they seemed to sway a little as he watched. Now, with a shock that chased the blood from his cheeks, he saw that they were alive, that they were moving, that they were coming at him. He had a momentary, scared glimpse of their faces, thin and unnaturally long, with long, drooping noses and drooping mouths of half-spectral, half-idiotic solemnity. Then he turned wildly to fly and found himself gripped by Devine. "Let me go," he cried. "Don't be a fool," hissed Devine, offering the muzzle of his pistol. Then, as they struggled, one of the things sent its voice across the water to them, an enormous horn-like voice far above their heads. "They want us to go across," said Weston. Both the men were forcing him to the water's edge. He planted his feet, bent his back, and resisted donkey fashion. Now the other two were in the water, pulling him, and he was still on the land. He found that he was screaming. Suddenly a second, much louder and less articulate noise broke from the creatures on the far bank. Weston shouted too, relaxed his grip on Ransom, and suddenly fired his revolver, not across the water, but up it. Ransom saw why at the same moment. A line of foam like the track of a torpedo was speeding towards them, and in the midst of it some large, shining beast. Devine shrieked a curse, slipped and collapsed into the water. Ransom saw a snapping jaw between them, and heard the deafening noise of Weston's revolver again and again beside him, and almost as loud, the clamor of the monsters on the far bank, who seemed to be taking the water too. He had had no need to make a decision. The moment he was free, he had found himself automatically darting behind his captors, then behind the spaceship and on, as fast as his legs could carry him into the utterly unknown beyond it. As he rounded the metal sphere, a wild confusion of blue, purple, and red met his eyes. He did not slacken his pace for a moment's inspection. He found himself splashing through water and crying out not with pain, but with surprise, because the water was warm. In less than a minute he was climbing out onto dry land again. He was running up a steep incline. And now he was running through purple shadow between the stems of another forest of the huge plants. Chapter 8. A month of inactivity, a heavy meal, and an unknown world do not help a man to run. Half an hour later, Ransom was walking, not running, through the forest, with a hand pressed to his aching side and his ears strained for any noise of pursuit. The clamor of revolver shots and voices behind him, not all human voices, had been succeeded first by rifle shots and calls at long intervals, and then by utter silence. As far as eye could reach, he saw nothing but the stems of the great plants about him receding in the violet shade, and far overhead the multiple transparency of huge leaves filtering the sunshine to the solemn splendor of twilight in which he walked. Whenever he felt able, he ran again. The ground continued soft and springy, covered with the same resilient weed which was the first thing his hands had touched in Malacandra. Once or twice a small red creature scuttled across his path, but otherwise there seemed to be no life stirring in the wood. Nothing to fear, except the fact of wandering unprovisioned and alone in a forest of unknown vegetation thousands or millions of miles beyond the reach or knowledge of man. But Ransom was thinking of Sorns, for doubtless those were the Sorns, those creatures they had tried to give him to. They were quite unlike the horrors his imagination had conjured up, and for that reason had taken him off his guard. They appealed away from the Wellesian fantasies to an earlier, almost infantile complex of fears. Giants, ogres, ghosts, skeletons, those were its key words. Spooks on stilts, he said to himself. Surrealistic bogeymen with their long faces. At the same time, the disabling panic of the first moments was ebbing away from him. The idea of suicide was now far from his mind. Indeed, he was determined to back his luck to the end. He prayed, and he felt his knife. He felt a strange emotion of confidence and affection towards himself. He checked himself on the point of saying, "We'll stick to one another." The ground became worse and interrupted his meditation. He had been going gently upwards for some hours, with steeper ground on his right, apparently half-scaling, half-skirting, a hill. His path now began to cross a number of ridges, spurs, doubtless, of the higher ground on the right. He did not know why he should cross them, but for some reason he did. Possibly a vague memory of earthly geography, suggesting that the lower ground would open out to bare places between wood and water where Sorns would be more likely to catch him. As he continued crossing ridges and gullies, he was struck with their extreme steepness. But somehow they were not very difficult to cross. He noticed, too, that even the smallest hummocks of earth were of an unearthly shape, too narrow, too pointed at the top, and too small at the base. He remembered that the waves on the blue lakes had displayed a similar oddity. And glancing up at the purple leaves, he saw the same theme of perpendicularity, the same rush to the sky, repeated there. They did not tip over at the ends. Vast as they were, air was sufficient to support them, so that the long aisles of the forest all rose to a kind of fan tracery. And the Sorns, likewise, he shuddered as he thought it, they too were madly elongated. He had sufficient science to guess that he must be on a world lighter than the earth, where less strength was needed, and nature was set free to follow her skyward impulse on a super-terrestrial scale. This set him wondering where he was. He could not remember whether Venus was larger or smaller than Earth, and he had an idea that she would be hotter than this. Perhaps he was on Mars, perhaps even on the Moon. The latter he at first rejected on the ground that, if it were so, he ought to have seen the Earth in the sky when they landed. But later he remembered having been told that one face of the Moon was always turned away from the Earth. For all he knew, he was wandering on the Moon's outer side. And, irrationally enough, this idea brought about him a bleaker sense of desolation than he had yet felt. Many of the gullies which he crossed now carried streams, blue hissing streams, all hastening to the lower ground on his left. Like the lake, they were warm, and the air was warm above them, so that as he climbed down and up the sides of the gullies, he was continually changing temperatures. It was the contrast, as he crested the farther bank of one such small ravine, which first drew his attention to the growing chilliness of the forest. And as he looked about him, he became certain that the light was failing, too. He had not taken night into his calculations. He had no means of guessing what night might be on Malacandra. As he stood gazing into the deepening gloom, a sigh of cold wind crept through the purple stems and set them all swaying, revealing once again the startling contrast between their size and their apparent flexibility and lightness. Hunger and weariness, long kept at bay by the mingled fear and wonder of his situation, smote him suddenly. He shivered and forced himself to proceed. The wind increased. The mighty leaves danced and dipped above his head, admitting glimpses of a pale and then a paler sky, and then, discomfortingly, of a sky with one or two stars in it. The wood was no longer silent. His eyes darted hither and thither in search of an approaching enemy, and discovered only how quickly the darkness grew upon him. He welcomed the streams now for their warmth. It was this that first suggested to him a possible protection against the increasing cold. There was really no use in going farther. For all he knew, he might as well be walking towards danger as away from it. All was danger. He was no safer traveling than resting. Beside some stream, it might be warm enough to lie. He shuffled on to find another gully, and went so far that he began to think he had got out of the region of them. He had almost determined to turn back when the ground began falling steeply. He slipped, recovered, and found himself on a bank of a torrent. The trees, for as trees he could not help regarding them, did not quite meet overhead, and the water itself seemed to have some faintly phosphorescent quality, so that it was lighter here. The fall from right to left was steep. Guided by some vague picnicker's hankering for a better place, he went a few yards upstream. The valley grew steeper, and he came to a little cataract. He noticed dully that the water seemed to be descending a little too slowly for the incline, but he was too tired to speculate about it. The water was apparently hotter than that of the lake, perhaps nearer its subterranean source of heat. What he really wanted to know was whether he dared drink it. He was very thirsty by now, but it looked very poisonous, very unwatery. He would try not to drink it. Perhaps he was so tired that thirst would let him sleep. He sank on his knees and bathed his hands in the warm torrent. Then he rolled over in a hollow close beside the fall and yawned. The sound of his own voice yawning, the old sound heard in night nurseries, school dormitories, and in so many bedrooms, liberated a flood of self-pity. He drew his knees up and hugged himself. He felt a sort of physical, almost a filial love for his own body. He put his wristwatch to his ear and found that it had stopped. He wound it. Muttering, half whimpering to himself, he thought of men going to bed on the far distant planet Earth. Men in clubs and liners and hotels, married men and small children who slept with nurses in the room, and warm, tobacco-smelling men tumbling together in forecastles and dugouts. The tendency to talk to himself was irresistible. "We'll look after you, Ransom. We'll stick together, old man." It occurred to him that one of those creatures with snapping jaws might live in the stream. "You're quite right, Ransom," he answered mumblingly. "It's not a safe place to spend the night. We'll just rest a bit till you feel better, then we'll go on again. Not now. Presently." Chapter 9. It was thirst that woke him. He had slept warm, though his clothes were damp, and found himself lying in sunlight, the blue waterfall at his side dancing and coruscating with every transparent shade in the whole gamut of blue, and flinging strange lights far up to the underside of the forest leaves. Realization of his position, as it rolled heavily back upon consciousness, was unbearable. If only he hadn't lost his nerve, the sorns would have killed him by now. Then he remembered with inexpressible relief that there was a man wandering in the wood, poor devil. He'd be glad to see him. He would come up to him and say, "Hello, Ransom." He stopped, puzzled. No, it was only himself. He was Ransom. Or was he? Who was the man whom he had led to a hot stream and tucked up in bed, telling him not to drink the strange water? Obviously some newcomer who didn't know the place as well as he. But whatever Ransom had told him, he was going to drink now. He lay down on the bank and plunged his face in the warm, rushing liquid. It was good to drink. It had a strong mineral flavor, but it was very good. He drank again and found himself greatly refreshed and steadied. All that about the other Ransom was nonsense. He was quite aware of the danger of madness, and applied himself vigorously to his devotions and his toilet. Not that madness mattered much. Perhaps he was mad already, and not really on Malacandra, but safe in bed in an English asylum. If only it might be so. He would ask Ransom. Curse it! There his mind went playing the same trick again. He rose and began walking briskly away. The delusions recurred every few minutes as long as this state of his journey lasted. He learned to stand still mentally, as it were, and let them roll over his mind. It was no good bothering about them. When they were gone, you could resume sanity again. Far more important was the problem of food. He tried one of the trees with his knife. As he expected, it was toughly soft like a vegetable, not hard like wood. He cut a little piece out of it, and under this operation, the whole gigantic organism vibrated to its top. It was like being able to shake the mast of a full-rigged ship with one hand. When he put it in his mouth, he found it almost tasteless, but by no means disagreeable, and for some minutes he munched away contentedly. But he made no progress. The stuff was quite unswallowable and could only be used as a chewing gum. As such, he used it, and after it many other pieces, not without some comfort. It was impossible to continue yesterday's flight as a flight. Inevitably, it degenerated into an endless ramble, vaguely motivated by a search for food. The search was necessarily vague, since he did not know whether Malacandra held food for him, nor how to recognize it if it did. He had one bad fright in the course of the morning, when, passing through a somewhat more open glade, he became aware first of a huge yellow object, then two of them, and then of an indefinite multitude coming towards him. Before he could fly, he found himself in the midst of a herd of enormous pale furry creatures, more like giraffes than anything else he could think of, except that they could and did raise themselves on their hind legs and even progress several paces in that position. They were slenderer and very much higher than giraffes and were eating the leaves off the tops of the purple plants. They saw him and stared at him with their big liquid eyes, snorting in basso profondissimo, but had apparently no hostile intentions. Their appetite was voracious. In 5 minutes they had mutilated the tops of a few hundred trees and admitted a new flood of sunlight into the forest. Then they passed on. This episode had an infinitely comforting effect on Ransom. The planet was not, as he had begun to fear, lifeless except for Sorns. Here was a very presentable sort of animal, an animal which man could probably tame, and whose food men could possibly share. If only it were possible to climb the trees. He was staring about him with some idea of attempting this feat, when he noticed that the devastation wrought by the leaf-eating animals had opened a vista overhead, beyond the plant tops, to a collection of the same greenish-white objects which he had seen across the lake at their first landing. This time they were much closer. They were enormously high, so that he had to throw back his head to see the top of them. They were something like pylons in shape, but solid, irregular in height and grouped in an apparently haphazard and disorderly fashion. Some ended in points that looked from where he stood as sharp as needles, while others, after narrowing towards the summit, expanded again into knobs or platforms that seemed to his terrestrial eyes ready to fall at any moment. He noticed that the sides were rougher and more seamed with fissures than he had realized at first, and between two of them he saw a motionless line of twisting blue brightness, obviously a distant fall of water. It was this which finally convinced him that the things, in spite of their improbable shape, were mountains. And with that discovery, the mere oddity of the prospect was swallowed up in the fantastic sublime. Here, he understood, was the full statement of that perpendicular theme which beast and plant and earth all played on Malacandra. Here in this riot of rock, leaping and surging skyward like solid jets from some rock fountain, and hanging by their own lightness in the air, so shaped, so elongated, that all terrestrial mountains must ever after seem to him to be mountains lying on their sides. He felt a lift and lightening at the heart. But next moment his heart stood still. Against the pallid background of the mountains, and quite close to him, for the mountains themselves seemed but a quarter of a mile away, a moving shape appeared. He recognized it instantly as it moved slowly, and he thought stealthily, between two of the denuded plant tops. The giant stature, the cadaverous leanness, the long, drooping, wizard-like profile of a Sorn. The head appeared to be narrow and conical. The hands, or paws, with which it parted the stems before it as it moved, were thin, mobile, spidery, and almost transparent. He felt an immediate certainty that it was looking for him. All this he took in an infinitesimal time. The ineffaceable image was hardly stamped onto his brain before he was running as hard as he could into the thickest of the forest. He had no plan save to put as many miles as he could between himself and the Sorn. He prayed fervently that there might be only one. Perhaps the wood was full of them. Perhaps they had the intelligence to make a circle round him. No matter. There was nothing for it now but sheer running, running knife in hand. The fear had all gone into action. Emotionally, he was cool and alert and ready as he ever would be, for the last trial. His flight led him downhill at an ever-increasing speed. Soon the incline was so steep that if his body had had terrestrial gravity, he would have been compelled to take to his hands and knees and clamber down. Then he saw something gleaming ahead of him. A moment later, he emerged from the wood altogether. He was standing, blinking in the light of sun and water, on the shore of a broad river, and looking out on a flat landscape of intermingled river, lake, island, and promontory, the same sort of country on which his eyes had first rested in Malacandra. There was no sound of pursuit. Ransom dropped down on his stomach and drank, cursing a world where cold water appeared to be unobtainable. Then he lay still to listen and to recover his breath. His eyes were upon the blue water. It was agitated. Circles shuddered, and bubbles danced 10 yards away from his face. Suddenly the water heaved, and a round, shining black thing like a cannonball came into sight. Then he saw eyes and mouth, a puffing mouth bearded with bubbles. More of the thing came up out of the water. It was gleaming black. Finally, it splashed and wallowed to the shore and rose, steaming, on its hind legs, 6 or 7 feet high and too thin for its height, like everything in Malacandra. It had a coat of thick black hair, looser than sealskin, very short legs with webbed feet, a broad beaver-like or fish-like tail, strong forelimbs with webbed claws or fingers, and some complications halfway up the belly which Ransom took to be its genitals. It was something like a penguin, something like an otter, something like a seal. The slenderness and flexibility of the body suggested a giant stoat. The great round head, heavily whiskered, was mainly responsible for the suggestion of seal, but it was higher in the forehead than a seal's, and the mouth was smaller. There comes a point at which the actions of fear and precaution are purely conventional, no longer felt as terror or hope by the fugitive. Ransom lay perfectly still, pressing his body as well down into the weed as he could, in obedience to a wholly theoretical idea that he might thus pass unobserved. He felt little emotion. He noted in a dry, objective way that this was apparently to be the end of his story, caught between a Sorn from the land and a big black animal from the water. He had, it is true, a vague notion that the jaws and mouth of the beast were not those of a carnivore, but he knew that he was too ignorant of zoology to do more than guess. Then something happened which completely altered his state of mind. The creature, which was still steaming and shaking itself on the bank, had obviously not seen him, opened its mouth, and began to make noises. This in itself was not remarkable, but a lifetime of linguistic study assured Ransom almost at once that these were articulate noises. The creature was talking. It had language. If you are not yourself a philologist, I am afraid you must take on trust the prodigious emotional consequences of this realization in Ransom's mind. A new world he had already seen, but a new, an extraterrestrial, a non-human language was a different matter. Somehow he had not thought of this in connection with the Sorns. Now it flashed upon him like a revelation. The love of knowledge is a kind of madness. In the fraction of a second which it took Ransom to decide that the creature was really talking, and while he still knew that he might be facing instant death, his imagination had leaped over every fear and hope and probability of his situation to follow the dazzling project of making a Malacandrian grammar. An introduction to the Malacandrian language, the lunar verb, a concise Martian English dictionary, the titles flitted through his mind. And what might one not discover from the speech of a non-human race? The very form of language itself, the principle behind all possible languages, might fall into his hands. Unconsciously, he raised himself on his elbow and stared at the black beast. It became silent. The huge bullet head swung round, and lustrous amber eyes fixed on him. There was no wind on the lake or in the wood. Minute after minute, in utter silence, the representatives of two so far divided species stared each into the other's face. Ransom rose to his knees. The creature leaped back, watching him intently, and they became motionless again. Then it came a pace nearer, and Ransom jumped up and retreated, but not far. Curiosity held him. He summoned up his courage and advanced, holding out his hand. The beast misunderstood the gesture. It backed into the shallows of the lake, and he could see the muscles tightening under its sleek pelt, ready for sudden movement. But there it stopped. It, too, was in the grip of curiosity. Neither dared let the other approach, yet each repeatedly felt the impulse to do so himself, and yielded to it. It was foolish, frightening, ecstatic, and unbearable all in one moment. It was more than curiosity. It was like a courtship, like the meeting of the first man and the first woman in the world. It was like something beyond that. So natural is the contact of sexes, so limited the strangeness, so shallow the reticence, so mild the repugnance to be overcome, compared with the first tingling intercourse of two different but rational species. The creature suddenly turned and began walking away. A disappointment like despair smote Ransom. "Come back!" he shouted in English. The thing turned, spread out its arms, and spoke again in its unintelligible language. Then it resumed its progress. It had not gone more than 20 yards when Ransom saw it stoop down and pick something up. It returned. In its hand, he was already thinking of its webbed forepaw as a hand, it was carrying what appeared to be a shell. The shell of some oyster-like creature, but rounder and more deeply domed. It dipped the shell in the lake and raised it full of water. Then it held the shell to its own middle and seemed to be pouring something into the water. Ransom thought with disgust that it was urinating in the shell. Then he realized that the protuberances on the creature's belly were not genital organs nor organs at all. It was wearing a kind of girdle hung with various pouch-like objects, and it was adding a few drops of liquid from one of these to the water in the shell. This done, it raised the shell to its black lips and drank, not throwing back its head like a man, but bowing it and sucking like a horse. When it had finished, it refilled the shell and once again added a few drops from the receptacle. It seemed to be some kind of skin bottle at its waist. Supporting the shell in its two arms, it extended them towards Ransom. The intention was unmistakable. Hesitantly, almost shyly, he advanced and took the cup. His fingertips touched the webbed membrane of the creature's paws, and an indescribable thrill of mingled attraction and repulsion ran through him. Then he drank. Whatever had been added to the water was plainly alcoholic. He had never enjoyed a drink so much. "Thank you," he said in English. "Thank you very much." The creature struck itself on the chest and made a noise. This book is continued on cassette number 3, side 1.